You're on 121.5, the emergency frequency.
Welcome to the 21.5 Show, a podcast for professional pilots by professional pilots. Join Dylan and Max, both with experience in flight instruction, the airlines, and business aviation, as they talk to a variety of industry experts, share stories, and have a little fun along the way.
Happy holidays, Max.
Thank you.
We're back for one last episode.
One last one.
2021. Are you sitting by the fire with your dog at your feet, a glass of hot eggnog?
Negative.
No. What are for the kids that aren't professional pilots yet? Tell them what you're doing.
I'm sitting at the hotel after diverting last night late.
A little New Year's Eve diversion.
Christmas Eve diversion.
Yeah, sorry. Are you staying at a DoubleTree at least? Did you get a nice warm
cookie?
Yeah, it is.
I am at the DoubleTree, but no, I did not get the cookie. Thank you for rubbing that in.
Oh, man. Well, we wanted to put together one last episode for everyone. Figured there's going to be a lot of folks flying over the holidays, so we had a great conversation with our new friend Dan. He talked to us about the incredible world of utility helicopter flying.
Mysterious world.
Yeah.
For us.
Long lining.
Nose.
Yeah. You're going to learn a lot from Dan, who has his own podcast, and he's a talented broadcaster. I think you guys will enjoy that conversation. Before that, I wanted to do a quick follow-up. You know, we did that funny, not that useful PSA about the 5G AD thing, where we had just liked playing the piano music, but didn't actually give any helpful information. Turns out there is some helpful information folks need to know, and that's they need to print out a little handout, a little flyer to put in their AFM, most likely, and that needs to go in prior to January 4th of 2022, and it just talks about add some language into your limitations section. My guess is you probably have already gotten an email from your OEM about it. I don't know. Did Cessna send you guys anything?
Yeah.
The XLS?
Yep. That's pretty cut and dry.
Yep. And we got something from our
friends. Just got to remember to do it, because I bet on the ramp checklist will be checking for that AD in 2022.
Yeah. They'll be mostly focused on making sure that you comply with the AD and not focused on preventing towers from getting installed by air. Standard deal. All right. Quickly jumping into the reviews today. We did get one review from The Tasty Fish. Do you want to read that one?
Yeah, not just for the pros. Thanks for putting out a great show. I've learned a lot listening to you guys. I just got my private pilot's license in August, and I'm striving to become a wide-body captain someday. I appreciate the insight you offer, and because of your show, my wife and I have finally taken control of our finances. The episode where you had Josh Flatley from X-Vector led me, who also lives in Reno, to reach out. And now my wife and I are feeling way more optimistic about our financial future. So thanks. Keep putting out the great content and come visit the air races in Reno by The Tasty Fish.
Well, you were at the air races.
I was, indeed.
Yeah, I didn't see you. Well, I did sage advice. We have some good financial advice coming up at the end of the flight advice section again here, so. Glad people are getting some good info out of it.
I love how we continue to contradict ourselves and not taking finance. Yeah. Well, I guess we're not the ones giving the finance.
We're not giving it, though. That's a secret.
Yeah, it just, on the surface, looks contradictory, I suppose.
Exactly. Thanks for the review. If you want some free swag, just shoot us an email, info@215podcast.com, with your mailing address, and I'll shoot some in the mail to you. And that goes for anyone else that writes us a review on Apple as well. Jumping into the mailbag, a very, very large Santa-sized mailbag today. Brought to you by our friends at Advanced Air Crew Academy, the authority when it comes to online training for business aviation flight departments. You can check out all of their offerings at aircrewacademy.com, Winter Ops, CPDLC, RVSM, you name it, they've got it. Way better than that other brand with those initials we won't even mention, because we don't want to give any 135 guys a PTSD. aircrewacademy.com. Thanks, guys. Okay, first one. Good morning, gents. Well, you know what? I should preface this whole thing. Today was like our end of the year wrap up where we reached out to a lot of our all-stars over the years. We got Tom Haig emailed in. We got emails from Ted. We got emails from Tim, a bunch of people. So we just reached out to a lot of our friends here to help us out with this one. So for the first one, it says, good morning, gents. Been a long time listener and would love some mentorship. I'm currently a CFI with a little more than 500 total time. Through networking, I've been offered a job to co-captain a Lear 55 for Part 91 owner. They will send me to formal type rating training and sit 50 hours right seat before taking over as PIC. My question is this common for Part 91 to take someone with no jet time and make them co-captain? And is the Lear Jet 55 hard to learn? Thanks so much. Keep up your amazing work. Blue skies. And that's from Cessna to Rocket. Your initial reaction?
The answer is no. That's not normal. And that's highly unlikely, obviously, for multiple different reasons.
Yeah. So a lot of red flags went off when I read that email. I can't speak to the emailer. I know at 500 hours, I would not have 550 hours. I would not be a competent Learjet captain. I don't think 50 hours right seat is enough to get turned loose in a jet, in my opinion. That's just me. The number one thing I was like, no one is going to insure this.
I don't think you can even get a PIC type rating at flight safety with that time. I don't think they'll allow that.
No. So, we already emailed this listener, but my advice is ask a lot more questions. This is my guess. This is a bait and switch. My guess is they're going, yeah, come on. And then, once you get there, flight safety says you just get an SIC. And then, I don't know. I emailed Tom Haig as well. He replied with a very long answer, but basically said, no effing way they're going to insure you. So he was saying, like regular PIC, you're looking at 2,500 to 3,000 total time and 500 to 1,000 jet. So I think that's good for any listener that, kind of set your expectations on where you're going to need to be experience-wise. And that's why Max and I always recommend that right after instruction, you go grind.
Grind it out.
And go fly a lot. Yep. Yeah, because you need to hit that 3,000 at total time magic number. So thanks to Tom Haig for his response there. We'll have a link to Wings Insurance if you want to get a hold of Tom. Okay, next email. Go ahead.
Long-time listener, first time, whatever this form is. Hey, I love your show for the wide variety of material that you include across the whole range of professional pilot employment. Great content, great tone. I usually listen during my workouts. My background is also wide-ranging. I learned to fly in a 172, ended up flying an F-16 for 20 years, went to the USAF test pilot school and did some bizjet contract flying, tried 121 flying, now working as a test pilot again. It's a bit of a long story. Anyway, one of the guys I went to 650 recurrent with asked me to explain fly-by-wire in a non-technical way. Nearly every new commercial aircraft is fly-by-wire, but the flight manual doesn't go beyond what to do, never really explaining why it works that way. I ended up writing an ebook to explain fly-by-wire concepts from a pilot perspective, and I thought you guys might be interested. Can I send you a copy? It's called Introduction to Fly-by-Wire Flight Control Systems, The Professional Pilot's Guide to Understanding Modern Aircraft Controls. Thanks, and keep up the great work, David. I'm interested. It's just kind of like one of those voodoo things that, they never really tell you about how it works because you don't really have any, obviously, control over it. I think that's the whole point. But
neither of us have flown. I've never flown a fly-by-wire airplane. So, there's like direct law and alternate law. And like, I'm probably screwing those terms up, but I don't really understand any of that. That was good. So, yeah, we'll have a link to that. That sounds good. Thanks, David. Okay, last email. And it's really long. So I'm going to do my best to paraphrase. It's from Nate. And he is emailing in defense of Heber Airport. The very long email talking about, well, he says, my comments are not meant to sound hostile or angry. My goal is to offer constructive criticism. So he goes on to explain Heber and why it is what it is from the Terps perspective. And, you know, it's a challenge to get in there. But he makes a good point. You know, the aircraft may or may not qualify to get in there. And he says the pilot may or may not qualify to get in there. So, you know, from a skill standpoint. So but he loves Heber. And the bottom line is, I think to me, he's like, hey, in this current climate, there's a lot of people that are trying to close airports down and restrict access. And he says that people like us with a platform are going to go on there and say, hey, you know, this airport should be shut down, or I hate this airport. He says that could be used against the community, you know, for people that are trying to close down an airport like that. So I think that was a really good point, Nate. I appreciate that. My problem with Heber is not anything to do with the approaches or the geography so much. My whole complaint was from an operational standpoint. Just fuel's way more expensive. It can take a long time to get out of there because of waiting for clearances and that kind of stuff. So I'm taking off my like business aviation cheerleader hat and then just saying, now I'm putting on my like captain hat and saying, what's the best for my passengers?
Well, the reason all of those things are what they are is because it's a cool place. Anywhere that's cool.
Yeah.
You know, that's close to the hot zone, as you say, is going to have high fuel prices and a lot of hassle because it's busy. That's just the way it is.
Right. And my whole point was, yeah, that's fine. There are a bunch of other airports that are only like 15 minutes from.
Yeah, that's true. It's like the difference between Aspen and Rifle is a lot bigger than Salt Lake and Heber.
Yeah, that's my whole point. It's like you have another option. So
I do appreciate his digging into the Terps. That's interesting. He had a good perspective.
It was really good. So thank you for that email, Nate. We appreciate it. Point taken. I'm still going to.
Well, what's interesting too is these airports like that are challenging from a Terps perspective and things like that. They're starting to offer, you know, everyone knows like the special procedure and special minimums in Aspen for 121, and you can get it at, you know, the training. It's pretty extensive, but there's some other airports where, like in Telluride, there's a special approach that you have to have approval to get, and it's not insurmountable. Like a lot of these things are very difficult if you're like Part 91 or just whatever. But I think that's kind of a good program they have where you can get some additional training that's not ridiculous for people that are very familiar with that airport and things that can afford some lower minimums because of you meet some requirements.
Sure. And to his point too, like those kinds of airports as a pilot are fun to fly into because there is a challenge or something unique, you know, it's something different and that's fun. And I get that. I mean, you and I have talked many times about enjoying flying into Telluride and Aspen and other airports, but I do think there's, you know, a balance of other factors to consider beyond that. So thanks for the perspective, Nate. Appreciate it. All right. Well, thanks to everyone who wrote in the mailbag. If you want to send in comments to it, it's info@215podcast.com, or you can visit 215podcast.com and click on the contact button.
That's the anonymous at the bottom way to do it, right?
Well, if you do the contact.
Yeah, via the website.
Then that via the website, no, we still get your name. If you use the flight advice form, that's anonymous.
Oh, that's what I was referring to.
Good. Thank you for teaming me up, because up next is coming up is flight advice. But first, Max, do you have any flight advice to give our listeners? Perhaps from a sponsor of ours?
Of course I do, Dylan. Don't be ridiculous. Protecting your medical certificate is one of the most important things you can do as a professional pilot. And that is why we have teamed up with our friends at Harvey Watt, who provide loss of medical insurance to professional pilots. Whether you're 91, 135, an airline person, or whatever, it is available, and it is probably more reasonably priced than you realize. Next time you go in to renegotiate your compensation package as a corporate pilot, or if you have questions about the insurance that's afforded to you by your airline employer, look no further than harveywatt.com.
Flight advice today comes from a major airline pilot who's grappling with a quandary that I think folks in our age bracket are starting to deal with. So, you know, it's funny, you know, as your career progresses, the decisions you have to make are so different. You know, we've talked about when you're young and you're building flight time, you take the first upgrade you can get, you take the opportunity, you move, you know, flexibility is the key to air power. Flexibility is the key to increasing your career. And then, you know, you get to where we're at, you know, maybe late 30s, early 40s, you got a spouse, a family potentially. And then you get that upgrade opportunity at the major airline. And I feel like that's like a different strategy for a lot of folks than at the regionals.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, for sure. Well, yeah. And these decisions are different for every person that makes it, right?
Yep.
So.
Right. It's not like you're just at a regional and you go, oh, take the upgrade. You get an upgrade, take it. You know, it doesn't matter.
I think
just go for it.
Put the big highlights of each decision into like these different buckets, but the finer points are all so situation dependent that, and person dependent. Yep. You know, just what if you can.
Yep.
What you can put up.
So
with.
We have a listener who is going through this right now. He says, "I'm 48 years old, and he's been with his major airline for about 8 years. He's been flying 121 for 27 years, or I'm sorry, in 27 years of flying, he's never had the opportunity to be a captain at a 121 operation." So he's very excited about the possibility. He said the downside, of course, is that taking that first available upgrade means a commute halfway across the country to the airline's least desirable domicile. He lives in a different domicile right now. So he made a pro and con list, which you're a fan of doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he said, here's some of the pros of upgrading. Would like to see the upgrade while he'd really like to upgrade while my dad is still alive to see it. I followed in his footsteps as an airline pilot. He was his dad was his first flight instructor. It would be meaningful for both of him to see everything come full circle. He gets 4 stripes. He gets more money with sick time, obviously at the captain level. His retirement isn't where he would like it to be due to some furloughs earlier in his career. So a little extra pay might allow him to get some extra money for retirement. And he thinks if there's any black swan event coming up, in the event of a merger or something like that, it'd be better to be in the left seat than the right seat. So those are kind of the pros. Why don't you read some of the cons he's got, Max?
So his son is now a sophomore in high school. And if he begins commuting to junior reserve, he's going to miss out on a lot of important things. You know, commuting is obviously a big one, time consuming, expensive, and he's done it before and doesn't want to do it again, but most junior domicile has only 2 nonstops a day from his current domicile, which for those of you, that translates into more lost time. Hotels are expensive, and I think I'm too old to share a crash pad and be stuck on the top bunk with a bunch of other guys snoring around me. So what do you guys think? First available upgrade, hopefully before I turn 50, and finally switch seats. Nobody wants to go all the way to the moon and be Michael Collins after all, or wait some indeterminate amount of time to hold captain in my domicile or in one that's a little more communicable. It's not the money, really. I think that after doing this for so long, I just kind of want to see what the other seat feels like for a while. Could always downgrade with a 4-month lock if I decide it's not for me. I know this isn't your usual flight advice from an industry newbie, and you're both younger than I am by a few years, so I'm not sure you'll be able to relate, but would be interested in your thoughts nonetheless. Thanks. Always from a faithful listener. That's from Mike. Go ahead, Dylan.
Okay. So, we tackled this flight advice a little bit differently because we actually reached out to some people to give some perspective, some of our listeners and some of our friends that we know that are commuters, especially, and kind of shared some of this information to get their take. So I'm going to give my take and then I'll let you give your take. We're going to talk to a few of our friends to get their takes and then we'll wrap it all up. In a nutshell, I used to commute. I would not commute. I would stay as an FO, especially because he's in base. And I think financially you can make up a lot of that money. Senior FO living in base versus junior captain, I feel like wouldn't be that different if you knew how to work the system a little bit. I think really the question is, do I do this upgrade now or do I wait 3 years till my kid graduates high school? You know, I'd just wait. You're never going to get that time back. Max?
Well, I think as everybody knows, I'm vehemently opposed to commuting as I'm currently being forced to. And the amount of time wasted just, it irritates me to my core. So, but that being said, that for some people is not that big of a deal. I see a lot of people at the commuter hotel that are coming in that are going to commute the rest of their career if they don't want to move because they live somewhere where there's no domicile, and they've accepted that and it's worth it. And so it doesn't sound like, though, in his situation that he's one of those people. He doesn't, you know, the commuting thing is just so difficult. And I think that given where the we don't know necessarily which major airline he works for, but if you look at all of the major airlines, things are going to be cranking. And it's a matter of, like, he's waited this long. So, you know, play the premium game at home, be there for your kids, and then punch out at that point. That's, you're still in this situation and these same options are afforded to you. But yeah, I would stay the senior FO. I mean, it sounds like his biggest motivation is the guy just wants to be a captain, and which is a valid,
totally legit. Totally legit. Yeah.
Absolutely. But you really, like, it's just, okay. So you know how, like, when you're a kid, or even now, like, I'm kind of still a kid, but if there's something I want, like, you know, things are gonna be so awesome when you get it and this and that. And then, like, you get it, and then it's just like a new car, right? You're so excited for this new car. And then a month later, you know, it's not so new anymore, but you're still stuck with the car payment or something like that. You know what I mean? And I think that this is going to be similar like that, where it's like, oh, I made it. And you go to upgrade and you're captain. And then a month later, you know, the newness kind of wears off, but you're stuck with the commute and you're just like, dude, what have I done? But he makes a point too. You could just go back. I mean, you don't hear about that. And, you know, I think we brush it off as a not very realistic option, but that's what I tell people in business aviation too. They're like, God, I don't know. Well, I regret leaving and going to the airlines. I'm like, you can always go back. This isn't like, you know, you're throwing the match in the house window as you walk away. You know, you can go back, and 4 months is the seat lock. It's not that long. So if he really just needs to wet his captain whistle, you could do that. Right.
I think you and I both know the amount of time and energy you put into a captain upgrade, though.
I agree. I don't, it's not.
You, the amount of work you've got to do to make captain and go through all that, go through OE, go through the fed ride, you know, go. I think there's a reason you don't hear about many guys going back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or gals.
For sure. I agree.
But yeah, it's a valid point. If you're miserable, you could.
Enough of our opinions, Dylan. Let's get to some fresh blood.
Okay. I wanted to look at a different angle here, Max, and that was where he mentioned the retirement contribution. You know, he said he was a little bit behind. We don't really know what that means. But I thought that was an interesting angle for us to look at and try and quantify, like, hey, what is this decision make if you defer an upgrade? What could that mean? Now, it's almost impossible because there's so many different variables. And, oh, are you picking up overtime? And how much are you contributing versus the match? And so we had to make a lot of assumptions. But what we ended up doing is reaching out to our friend Tim Pope, our new partner and financial advisor over at Terra Investments. And I gave him some baseline numbers. And we had to make some assumptions. But I was like, let's just try and quantify this. What would that actually mean? So I chatted with Tim a little bit about it, and here is the bottom line. And this is why I like Tim. He goes, when I explained it, he goes, dude, money ain't everything. If he was my client, I'd advise him probably just stay with his kid, you know, and enjoy the time, that he's at, and, you know, money and time, two different assets that you've got to value. But Tim did plug all this into the calculator for us, and, you know, making a bunch of assumptions, like I said, it came out, it was like $60,000. Was the difference. I that was cool that there are tools out there that are available for folks to look at that. You know?
At the end of the day, you mean $60,000?
Yeah. It's a difference of $60,000. Assuming everything else is held constant.
Was that, so that means flying the same credit as a captain or a foe?
Yeah. Basically just adjusting the salary
level. And the thing about that too is you could make that up in if you just grind a little bit on your own, you know, fly a couple of turns while your kid's at school, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, but I think that it's a cool to be able to quantify some of that stuff. And that's where I think, you know, you can get a value talking to a professional like Tim to help you kind of wade through some of that stuff.
Which I think I probably speak for most when I would say that's, I'm surprised by that, right? You thought it would be more? Yeah. Is that what you're?
Yeah. Okay. Now, I mean, again, we had to make a lot of assumptions here and we're trying to do an apples to apples. But, you know, I think if most people said, hey, you could pick 60 grand or 3 extra years being around with your kids before they leave the house, I think I know what most people would pick. So thanks to Tim for running those numbers for us. And we'll have a link to his info in our show notes. We did reach out to a couple other commuters that are our friends, Jordan. It's commuter. He had some perspective as well. The red flag he saw was the 2 nonstops a day. He already said,
"Yeah, like that's
going to be miserable.
That's going to be miserable. Yeah. So much lost time."
He said, "There's a reason the upgrade is available to junior pilots. The job sucks so much. Senior FOs don't want to do it." Last thing Jordan says is his father knows the drill and likely wishes for his son and grandson to be together when it matters. As soon as the kid is out of the house, then drop the hammer. But and then he says, on the upside, commuting would provide a lot of time to revisit all the past 21.5 show episodes.
That's awesome.
So, good. Thank you, Jordan, for your perspective.
Before I read Clint's, I think what's interesting is Clint's father was also an airline pilot. And so Clint kind of was in that set of shoes. But you'll notice he didn't mention that really at all.
Okay.
So anyway, that he says, that being said, he isn't out. Only four months seat lock. If he's going to be junior commuting to the worst base, well, if it walks like a duck, it will probably suck. At the same time, though, he can test the waters. He's blessed to have that bailout option. But remember, in the airline, things can change overnight, and it appears he knows from his career. Have zero expectations, and then you'll have zero disappointments. Then you have to face it day to day, or just wait till your son graduates. If it's not about the money, and tell your dad you're doing what's best for you and your family. Most fathers will respect that than doing something just to please them. Clint.
So I think most of us are in agreement, but I think that the icing on the cake here is our email from Ted. If you want to read that, Max, you know, anytime you can get advice from Ted, I think that's
always short and sweet. Let me get this straight. He's going to commute from one domicile to another to sit reserve. He should look up idiot in the dictionary, be a senior FO living in domicile and play the premium game. Wait till the upgrade comes to his home domicile. SMH. Ted. So the captain I'm flying is right now. We talked about this yesterday about taking the first available upgrade, and she took the first available upgrade and it worked out perfect for her because she took it and finished. And then a few months later went on this extended leave program. So she was sitting around doing nothing, which would have happened either way as a captain or FO, but was on captain pay doing it. So she's like, yeah, I basically just went back to FO pay, but I didn't have to show up to work. So, you know, she played it like a fiddle, which is incredible. And, you know, probably a once in a lifetime sort of situation, a once in a career, I guess you could say. But that's to his point. You never know. And whether you have to utilize that sick bank or whatever, you know, that is a careful consideration. But she said, but the thing is, too, what happens is if you take that first available upgrade, meaning that there's people that are bypassing and waiting, right? Then you have these senior people that are senior to you, but they're FOs, right? So as things get better and that carrot gets dangled in front of you, oh, look it, I'm getting pretty close to holding Dallas. What do you think those FOs that are senior to you do? They scoop up a captain vacancy.
Bid right over the top here.
So you end up just literally chasing the carrot until those all work through, which is the only one way to fix the seniority problem. That's with time, you know? And so that would be very tough, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we know what the answer is.
Yeah.
Our advice, at least. But keep us posted, Mike. We'd love to hear what you end up doing. And I think this is a useful conversation. I know we took a long time answering this and kind of going a little deeper than normal, but I think there are a lot of listeners that could be in this situation here. at the major or kind of their career.
Did you watch Ted Lasso?
Look, if you're at the regionals.
Did you watch the show Ted Lasso? What's the group called where they all howl, you know, when they talk about?
Diamond Dogs.
Yeah, the Diamond Dogs. We should create our own Diamond Dogs for these flight events.
Yeah.
That's it. Right. This is the start of the Diamond Dogs.
The Harvey Watt Diamond Dogs.
Yeah. Diamond Dogs sponsored by Harvey Watt. We might have to check with Harvey Watt, see if they're on board with the Diamond Dogs.
Yeah, see if they're in that. Just like me, you, Tim, Ted. We just have this little group. We need, and Ted can be the, what's the guy on it that is just like super brief?
Roy.
And super abrupt. Roy. Yes. Yeah.
What are you talking about? Oi. Who's going to commute from one base to another one? Don't be an idiot. I always wear black.
People that haven't seen Ted Lasso think we're total idiots right now, but
they're ready to tune out now. All right. Good luck, Mike.
Yeah. Let us know what you decide. That's the thing with these flight advice. I feel like we give all this advice and then I always want to hear how it turns out. So make sure you let us know, please.
Okay. On to the main event, Max. Are you ready?
Ready.
Ready to learn about something we know nothing about?
Super interesting.
All right, here we go. Let's talk to Dan. Max, it's our pleasure today to be joined by a peer, a fellow professional in the aviation broadcasting realm, Dan Dopker. He is the host of the Aloft with Dan podcast and a helicopter pilot, which neither of us know that much about. So we're excited to chat with you, Dan. Welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it. I appreciate you guys having me on the show. You guys' show is awesome. I've been following along and I'm catching up on some old episodes, but I aspire to be similar to you guys someday.
They get better as you go on. We found out.
It's regressing right now because I actually started from current shows. And
where you know, there you go. No, yeah, I'm so you're seeing like, kidding. Oh, well, it's good perspective.
You're going to get to episode 6 and be like, I think I'm out on these guys.
Wait till you get to 1. You'll be like,
oh, God. I actually listened to that the other day. It was bad. Cringe. But anyways, you're not suffering from those types of issues because I've listened to a couple of your early episodes and they are awesome. Your show is really cool because it just focuses on hearing stories from people that are doing awesome things in aviation. And that's why we want to have you on our show, because you're doing a lot of awesome things in aviation as well. So excited to hear a little bit about your background and some of the cool stuff you're doing in helicopters. So why don't you start us off with just telling us a little bit about your aviation journey so far?
Yeah, sure. I appreciate all that. Thank you, guys. Really, I started my aviation journey when I was young. I was like most of the like real, you know, passionate pilots. I've since I can remember wanted to be a pilot, and my old man used to go on this trip every year where they would fly in Cessna 206s and 185s into the backcountry of Montana. And so they would fly from a place called Red Eagle Aviation at Kalispell City Airport into this little strip called Schaefer Meadows. And it was this really cool rafting trip. I liked fishing. I wanted to go rafting, but I was too young at the time. And the airplanes were just fascinating. And so from there it was a goal. That was it. And I always wanted to go figure that out. So I jumped on the, you know, kind of figuring all that out while I was growing up. My parents were super supportive and helped me figure it out. I worked at FBOs, you know, traded time for lessons. My parents helped me figure out how to buy a Cessna 150 when I was 17 years old, which was, really, really brave of them. I'll share a few stories as we get, my best story is going to go at the end, but I did some dumb things with that 150. I was 17 years old. I had a private pilot license and an airplane. And so the girls, I was taking everybody up for rides. I was, you know, yeah, it was dangerous.
That's a dangerous combo. I can't even imagine.
Sounds great.
Yeah. I was too young to have an airplane, but no, it was great. I was able to build time in it, and I decided I wanted to go to school, and really I wanted to be a helicopter pilot at that time. And so my old man was great. We'd go to the airport and ask around, try to figure out how do you do this? You know, what do you do to get a helicopter rating? Cause I don't know anybody who knew that. And, a lot of them would say the military, and a lot of them would say, well, you can go civilian, but it's really expensive. And, you know, just, we didn't have the means to just go figure out how to pay for helicopter training. So I was going to go to North Dakota. I did go to North Dakota, actually, University of North Dakota. I think you guys are both ERU grads. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. We won't go into that right now. But for your sake, we won't. I appreciate that. Yeah, thank you. So I went to North Dakota. Really, the reason I went there was they had this really cool ROTC program with the Army, and you could go into helicopter training with them. They would essentially pay for pretty much all of your school, and you would start at Fort Rucker, which is the Army's helicopter training school, and you would be partway through the class when you got there. So you'd have your private instrument commercial. I don't think they did CFI, but that program has ended since then. That was back in 2004. And when I got there, it was 2004, so we were at war in Afghanistan. I was pretty nervous about the whole idea of going to Afghanistan, which is ironic because later you guys are going to find out I went to Afghanistan. When I was at the school, the ROTC thing just wasn't for me. I was like a small town kid from Montana. I was really unsure of that whole situation and all the people running it. And so I ended up just bagging that whole idea. I stuck with the airplanes. I already had my private and was working on my other ratings. So I did my other ratings through there. I got a degree in aviation management as my, you know, backup plan. Also another ironic thing. I ended up being a manager in aviation for quite a while. And so I went through and did all that. Afterwards, my now wife, but then girlfriend, had moved to Oregon to go to school at a little school here and do a doctorate program. She's way smarter than me, by the way. And so she went to school to be a doctorate in physical therapy here at a little school in, it's in Forest Grove. And so I was
Pacific,
here.
Right?
What's that?
Pacific.
Yep. Pacific University. Yeah. You got it. Yep. Yeah. So she went to school there and I decided, well, I'll move out here. At the time, she was living in Hillsboro. There's a really cool school here called Hillsboro Aviation. They're a big airplane and helicopter school. And I thought, well, I'll work there as a flight instructor and was able to essentially, they gave flight instructors, I was airplane flight instructor, but they gave us a 25% discount. This has also gone away. So anybody looking for that discount, I'm sorry, it's gone. I used it.
Mention offer code Aloft with Dan.
There you go. Yeah. maybe I have to talk to them. I might
be like nowhere better to do flight training than in sunny Oregon.
That's yeah. Yes. Yeah. As I'm looking outside, it's about an eighth of a mile of fog. I can't even see across the street.
I don't even understand how you get anything done.
I learned to do it on the Oregon coast, and the Oregon coast is pretty about as bad as it gets.
It's so true.
It can be done.
Yep. It's true. It's good for you, right? I mean, ultimately, some of that training is handy when you go out into the real world for sure. So, So I did they had a discount for helicopter training, and, you know, my wife, bless her, I came to her one day and said, hey, I want to take out another flight training loan. And we had no money at the time. She was going to school and I was a flight instructor. So, you know, we were basically scraping by, and she supported me. She helped me figure it out. And so we were able to get a helicopter training loan, and I got all of my helicopter add-ons, and then the rest just kind of went from there. So,
now hold on. I got to stop you here.
Please.
Sounds like the wife is the key ingredient here. Did you capture her via 150? A 150 Ooh. Sightseeing flight? Was that the secret weapon?
That's a great question. The answer is she knew me. We were dating actually before I even started in aviation. I was working for my dad who owns a landscaping company. So I was just digging ditches.
So the airplane sealed the deal then? Is that what you're saying?
There we go. Yeah. the airplane sealed the deal. And I think that maybe there's another thing I call the belly roll. And I'll tell you guys more about that later. Yeah. <Okay. laughs> The airplane and the belly roll.
Is the belly roll in the airplane or is that something different?
Oh, it's anywhere. The belly roll can be anywhere.
Technique only, yeah. Dylan. Okay. Technique only.
I can't really do it justice without showing you guys, so I'm not gonna put you through that. It's traumatic, so
okay. All right.
It kind of sounds like what I do in the morning when I get out of bed.
Yeah.
You might not even know it. Yeah. So yeah, no, she has been supportive and figured out a lot of ways to make things work. I mean, we're going to come to it here in a few minutes, but when I got to Afghanistan, she figured out how to make a month on, a month off work as a schedule. And that's with two small kids. And so she's a pretty rock star. I gotta give her some credit. And she started dating me before aviation was a thing in my life. So, you know, it was always a thing, but not before she knew what she signed up for. She is a saint.
So she got all of your helicopter ratings. You're instructing at this point. I guess this is a good time to talk about, like, what is the hill? Like, if you don't do military, what's the next step after you get all your ratings?
Yeah. So the path is very similar to an airplane path or a traditional airplane path where you get your ratings and then you flight instruct for a little while, build up your time. So a helicopter, you know, helicopter path is going to typically start out with getting your training done, obviously. And there's a few little unique caveats that I'll just throw out there. So the Robinson R-22 is the most popular training helicopter out there. And the R-22 has a SFAR, it's called, which is Special Federal Aviation Regulation, and it requires people to have 200 hours in a helicopter to be able to teach in a Robinson, along with some specific endorsements. You have to actually go up with an examiner, a DPE, and get signed off for your SFAR to be able to teach in a Robinson helicopter. The 44 has a few other differences, but very similar rules. The 66, which is their turbine, has none of those. It doesn't apply to the 66, or at least
to
my knowledge.
Wait, so could you teach in like an Enstrom or something like that without having to go through all those hoops? So
you could. An Enstrom. Go ahead.
So why is the most popular training helicopter have an SFAR? What spurred that?
I think the reason that it's the most popular is because it's pretty cheap. Yeah. So it's affordable, right? Relatively cheap, right? We're talking about aviation and helicopters, obviously, but it's got a lot of things in it that if you're not aware of them and you're not careful about, they'll kill you. You know, it's just, higher.
Isn't that all helicopters?
What's that?
Isn't that all helicopters?
It's true. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, you know, we can get into all the helicopter jokes about how they're trying to kill you. 1,000 parts all flying around, you know, coming apart. But
yeah, right.
Yeah, so the Robinson has a couple things going against it, which is a what they call low inertia rotor system. So the rotors are really they just don't have a lot of weight to them. And so if you start reducing the speed, the engine starts like bogging down, or you're getting to high altitudes, or you're reaching the max performance of that aircraft, then those RPMs start to come down. And when we get into tech, I can go all the way into this if you guys want, but when we get into the lift equation, velocity is a huge portion, right? Speed is
No, we don't talk about the lift equation on this show. That's a policy. Right, no, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Skip. Go ahead.
So yeah. So anyways, there's ways it'll kill you.
I don't know what his problem is.
Keep going. Yeah, I'm enjoying this.
All right. So as the velocity decreases of the rotor, right, just like if your speed decreases on an airplane, then you have to do something to compensate to maintain that same amount of lift. And so like in an airplane, you would increase your angle of attack, right? On a helicopter, it's similar where you increase the angle of attack, but increase of angle of attack means more drag. And so with an airplane, that would slow you down. In a helicopter, that slows your rotor down. And it's really difficult if that rotor gets too slow. Part of the strength, if you guys look at a helicopter, the blades are hanging down. Part of the strength comes from that rotational inertia. And so as it starts to slow down, then it continues to slow down. And eventually there won't be enough strength and they'll fold up. And they have accidents where they'll come up to the site and they know it was low RPM because the blades look like a tulip basically. And they've just folded up. So it's really important to manage your RPM when you're flying a helicopter. That's like, you guys just got helicopter 101. That's lesson one. Manage your RPM.
So it's like backside of the power curve.
It's similar.
Your entire lift device will be destroyed.
It's correct. Yeah, that's a pretty good way to put it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And so there's a couple other little things like that. I don't say a bunch. There's a few other little things. And ultimately, they had a ton of people that were killing themselves in the Robinson. And with this SFAR, it's reduced that substantially. And so there's a lot of good training out there now. There's a lot more emphasis put on making sure that people understand the aircraft. And then it's been very successful and there's been a lot fewer deaths because of it. So that's ultimately why. But Max, you're right. You could fly a Schweitzer, an Enstrom, a Jet Ranger, you know, whatever other aircraft that you could find to train. There's actually a Cabri now, it's called. And that one's been a pretty popular training helicopter that's rapidly coming up and may one day be more popular than the R-22. So,
interesting.
Yeah.
That's a good little lesson. So you basically had to start instructing then after you got all your ratings. That was, what are you going to pay for? Like if you get everything in 150 hours, And then you've got to like just buy time to get to your 200. Is that kind of what happens?
Yep. That's exactly it. It made it really easy to figure out how to budget for my loan that I needed to get, because I knew 200 hours was a magic number. And as an airplane to helicopter pilot, it was a more difficult transition than I thought. The ground school was very easy for the most part. I understood a lot about, you know, about the things, the aerodynamics and all that kind of stuff. There was a few minor differences, but overall pretty similar. The flying portion is totally different, not even in the same ballpark. It was insanely challenging. So I did a course where I decided I had this brilliant idea that I was going to save money and I was going to do my commercial add-on instead of my private add-on.
I've heard about people doing this. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the problem is if you do that, you have to get, I'm going to mess this number up. I should have looked it up before I did the show, but I think it's 35 hours of flight time as PIC, and nobody lets you do maneuvers in a helicopter solo. I've never seen one school that will allow you to go out solo in a helicopter and practice auto rotations, or, you know, they're pretty challenging maneuvers. It's not like an airplane where you can go out and like practice a stall or a slow flight, and it's not really a big deal. And so I ended up burning 35 hours of just like literally just flying solo cross country. No real benefit, you know? And, so I would advise, if anybody's out there thinking about it, do your private first. That way you can do your commercial training and you can count PIC time while you have an instructor with you, and it'll help you build some more experience and practice maneuvers while you're doing it, instead of just burning holes in the sky. A little bit more expensive, but totally worth the cost.
Yeah. It's interesting because they put these hour requirements for certain things like that. And it was funny when you said the 200 hour thing, I was thinking about that, and the FAA, they do that, and I understand, but it's funny because if they do like a task-based thing, it would be so much more effective, which is what they're changing. So I'm in this flight test period. I'm on my experimental airplane, 40 hours, right? And I'm getting to the point where I've completed all the tasks, and now I'm just burning time, like literally flying at min fuel flow, just around on autopilot, like just...
Yep. It's just not adding anything really.
Yeah, exactly. But what's funny is that they are actually changing that to task-based system, where now the law is going to change whenever they reissue the advisory circular, but it will be like they're getting rid of the hourly requirement, and it's like completion of your flight test, then you're cut loose, which is a much smarter way of doing it. So hopefully that, you know, continues to roll downstream to other things as well.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. I think, you know, the airplane to helicopter niche is pretty small. There's not a lot of people that do it, but it'd be really neat if they had something like that. It's a cool idea.
So you started instructing then after you got your 200. And what is the typical student that you see now that coming in to do the helicopter training? What's that look like?
It's like an airplane student. It's hard to describe one set standard that comes in. Ultimately, when I was training, we had a ton of people from the VA, a bunch of veterans who had VA funds, you know, they're using their post 9/11 GI Bill to get training done. There's still a few schools doing that, but there unfortunately were some schools that were grossly negligently using those funds, and it really hurt the industry as a whole, and ultimately the veterans probably more than anybody else. And so they've shut down a lot of that training. Our school, in my opinion, was doing a really good job. We weren't trying to use extra funds. We weren't trying to do training in fancy helicopters. It was all the same training we'd give the next person. And so I did a lot of training with vets, you know, getting them ready for their next steps. I did the school here in Hillsborough has, I don't remember how many countries, something like, you know, more than 15 countries represented at almost any time. And so we have a lot of foreigners that come and we do training. Specifically, I did a lot of training for Chinese students. We had groups of Chinese helicopter students that were here. Everybody from like the Beijing police would sponsor students to like there's offshore companies that would sponsor students, oil companies, stuff like that. And so we get a lot of that. And then after that, it's just people who, you know, it's a dream, it's a passion. They go out and find a way to finance it, which is getting easier now. And it used to be really challenging. You know, 2008, it was impossible to find financing, obviously, just like for a lot of other people. And now it's easier. So we'd get a lot of students that were just self-funded, figured out a way to get financing and wanted to be a career pilot. So,
yeah, you just wonder, like, I remember there's a lot of people that, oh, I want to do the Discovery flight. And it's always been a dream of mine to be an airplane pilot. And I feel like that's a chunk of the students. I would imagine that's less for the fixed wing. I could see that. But in the rotor wing, there's probably less of that, right?
Yeah. You know, I think it's probably the same, just a smaller proportion, right? You know, it's it's happens. We had Discovery flights. We did the whole thing, and there's people, I mean, I did a Discovery flight here, and ultimately I knew I wanted to fly helicopters. That was always a goal of mine that I kind of had in the back of my mind. And I did that Discovery flight and it was over. I had to figure it out then. That was it. So, but, yeah, so students from all over, yeah, you get the normal gamut. I personally ended up doing a lot of instrument training in helicopters. The helicopter instrument world is very small. There's not a lot of people who are experienced with IFR in the helicopter world. And obviously I was an airplane instructor here. I had my double I, we were flying in the Pacific Northwest. So I had actual time, which, you know, most of these guys were like, you know, they've never been in a cloud after 10, 15 years in the industry. So,
wow.
And if they have been in a cloud, it's probably really low over a side of a mountain while they're doing a logging mission or, you know, something.
Yeah. Or flying Kobe Bryant, maybe. Something like that.
Unfortunately. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's a sad state, but ultimately, you know, a very real thing for helicopters to push. And
so is that a thing? Like, cause it just doesn't happen that often that most people will avoid it at all costs versus picking up a clearance and flying in the clouds.
I think so. You know, ultimately I think that, in the helicopter side, they just don't have a lot of experience and a lot of comfort. You guys are really comfortable going in the clouds and going on an IFR clearance. And, you know, I don't know what you're going to do with your experimental aircraft, but I know that sometimes in the 182 that I fly around, I'll just pick up an IFR clearance just because it's convenient and easy. And
yeah, sure.
A lot of the helicopter guys will avoid that like the plague. They would rather stay low. I mean, they'd rather turn their transponder off and just, you know, rock and roll. That's not everybody. That certainly is not everybody, but some people, yeah.
Okay. All right, so let's keep going with your story a little bit. Tell us how you made it in the world of helicopters.
Sure. So yeah, so like every super excited CFI, I worked my tail off and made no money and ultimately got my hours. And so in the helicopter world, typically right now the airlines, the ATP mins are 1500. So a lot of CFIs and folks doing that are getting to 1500 and then going to find that regional job or whatever other, maybe intro into corporate world or, you know, however they're breaking it after they get some experience. In the helicopter world, that number is usually 1,000 hours. And the reason it's 1,000 hours is that's what most insurance companies are wanting and tour companies are wanting. So the typical progression would be you're a flight instructor and then you go do a tour job. So something like the Grand Canyon or Alaska, and you're flying your first turbine helicopter doing that. I got through my CFI and we just had a kid, which having a kid while you're CFI was a marginal decision. Let's face it.
Incredible. Yeah.
Brave at the minimum. so we decided that I wasn't ready to go on to that next step yet. And I wanted to just kind of sit around and see what would happen. At the time, the school was growing a lot and there was a lot of movement. And so I ended up actually staying at the school, just to summarize all of it, for 11 years, between fixed wing instruction, helicopter instruction. I became the chief instructor on the helicopter, school for a little while. I was a, general manager for a little bit. So that business degree did actually come in use, I guess, or handy. And ultimately stayed there for 11 years. The really cool thing about that company is they had a bunch of other operations going on. So when I first started there, they had the flight school, they had a charter department, they had aircraft sales, they did maintenance, they did, you know, all kinds of FBO, they had all this stuff going on. And while I was a chief instructor and all these other roles, they let me do some of the other stuff. So I got a turbine transition. I flew tours around Mount St. Helens, which is a super fun thing. I can tell you guys some cool stories. We flew like not into the volcano, but like it's all open on the north side and you can essentially fly right up to it and see the lava dome building up in it. There's steam coming off of it. It's super cool. If you ever get a chance to fly around Mount St. Helens, it's a really cool place. It's pretty neat.
What kind of helicopter do you do that in?
We did it in a Jet Ranger. So it's kind of I would say a Jet Ranger, right? Bell 206. It's like the classic iconic. Everybody thinks of as a helicopter when they think of that. So, and that job, I had no idea, but we lived in a hut up there. There's like a trailer house. Actually, it's not a hut, a trailer house. We worked out of this little hut and in a parking lot. And essentially we had one way in, one way out. So if the winds were real strong or anything like that, you basically had to deal with the tailwind and accept it. We would load up these people, you know, the people who want to fly around Mount St. Helens aren't, are oftentimes the people who don't want to hike to Mount St. Helens to see it, right? And so, you know, you're always trying to figure out, like, is this going to work? Are we going to be able to, you know, get off? And it was, the Jet Ranger worked, but it was pretty high altitude and pretty heavy weight a lot of times. And so it's actually a really good skill building exercise. You know, it helped me improve. I wasn't as scared as I should have been probably from that role.
Blissful ignorance, we call that.
That's exactly. Like our friends that flew the Canyon Airlines in the tour flights. It's the same thing. They like look back and like, oh my God.
Yeah, we made it, but just barely. And we didn't know how close. Yeah. So, yeah. So that was really great. They let me do all kinds of other things too. I did these survey flights. We went out, we'd count fish. They have radar antennas and they put tags in fish and you fly over a lake and they'll like literally count and map where in the lake these fish are or where in the river they are. So that was kind of neat. Flew eagle surveys, which is always great because one, eagle surveys are really cool because you get to see and count a lot of times baby eagles sitting in their nests. And usually the biologists are pretty entertaining and also oftentimes very cute. And so that was fun. We did a...
Wait, hold on. Let's talk about like count the process of counting an eagle nest. Yeah. Like, you know where the nests are, right?
Well,
so you can kind of fly to them.
A lot of times they do. Yeah. And then other times you're just flying in and looking for them. But for the most part, they have a lot of them marked. Yeah.
And then you're hovering above it. Has someone got it like binoculars or what?
So
how does that work?
We get pretty close. No binoculars needed. You can just see them. And it's like any flying thing. They need an approach and a departure path. So they have like an approach into them. And so there's this big opening where you can just look right in. So if you're up there eye level with them or a little higher, you can see right into it really easily. And we don't quite hover. We typically are moving around just above what we call ETL, which is essentially where you have fresh air flowing over the rotor. It's probably about 30 knots. So it's nice and slow, but super safe. You have a lot of lift and a lot of options if things get weird. So
have you ever got like come up and seen this nest and there's all these little babies and you get a little too close and then blow it out of the tree? And just everyone looks at each
That'd
other
be terrible,
like,
but no, that would be horrible. Well, yeah,
there's a cute biologist in the back goes, oh, you killed me.
There would be tears.
X those ones off onto the next nest.
Oops, let's go. No, they haven't luckily had that because there would be, yeah, it would be bad. But the one kind of crazy thing is that we had some Prairigen falcons who are apparently super territorial and they straight up fought the helicopter. Like, we had to leave because they were really worried we were going to kill it because it was dive bombing us and coming at the helicopter and trying to attack it. You know, you got this little Prairigen falcon. I don't know what they weigh, a pound and a half maybe, you know, and it's coming at this giant helicopter that's hovering near it or moving slowly near it. So yeah, they're Prairigen falcons. Watch out for those. So yeah, so we did all kinds of stuff. I did firefighting, which was super fun. I got to do some initial attack. And I had the best life then because I was home most of the time with my family and I was covering every 2 weeks, I would cover 2 days for a guy to have his off time during the summer. And so I'd go fight fires for 2 days and it was just like on the weekend, it was super fun. And then I go back to work, my regular job, you know, and it was a blast. So
that's awesome.
What kind of helicopter was that?
That was in a Long Ranger. So it's a 206. But it's a little bit bigger, 206, right? They got seven seats instead of five. We could only carry, I think it was like 98 gallons at the altitudes we were fighting fire at. It was pretty high altitudes. And so they take this Bambi bucket, which is the big orange buckets you guys see when you're looking at fire stuff with helicopters, and they cinch the smallest bucket down to the smallest size. It has like a big belt in it that you can pull to make it smaller. So yeah, 98 gallons. We're really just helping slow things down or maybe cool off the firefighters. It worked out great. It was fun.
It's like when my house is dirty and we're going to have guests over and then we ask our kids to like help clean the house.
Yes.
You're like, yeah, I'm helping.
It's more ceremonious.
That's exactly
I put
right.
my one toy away in the toy box. Right, thank you.
Here's a rag and they wipe like one corner of the wall and call it good. Yeah.
Meanwhile, you're burning more jet fuel than you are carrying water.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It was fun though. That was a good gig. So yeah, ultimately I didn't share this at the first part, but while I was in North Dakota, I was really I really wanted to fly helicopters, but I couldn't figure out how to afford them and all that kind of stuff. And I decided to get this magazine called Vertical Magazine. And in the first edition I got, they had like a supplement in it. And that supplement was all about this company called Columbia Helicopters. And Columbia Helicopters, they fly out of Aurora, Oregon, which I had no idea. I'd never even been to Oregon. Well, maybe I'd been to Oregon once. I really didn't remember Oregon or know Oregon at all. I had no idea where it was. They were flying these big aircraft that looked super cool, right? Chinooks and 107s, which is sort of like a baby Chinook, really, is kind of the best way to describe it. It looks very similar. And they were doing this whole supplement was just all about this guy and their 50th anniversary of creating this company and how neat their jobs were. And I kept that supplement. I actually still have it. And I kind of had that in the back of my mind as like where I'd want to work someday. And of course I'd been in Oregon for a while. So I'd found out a lot more about what they did. And I had some friends who were working for them. And so ultimately I decided that I was pretty worn out on the management side of things. And I was tired of wearing like fancy clothes to work. And I was tired of dealing with people. I just wanted to go fly helicopters again. And so I went and applied and got a job with them flying in Afghanistan. And so ultimately I ended up doing a little stint in Papua New Guinea. So for about 6 months, I was in Papua New Guinea. Basically it was a month on, month off schedule for all of it. And then after those first 6 months, I got a security clearance. You have to get a secret security clearance to be able to go to Afghanistan. And then I went over to Afghanistan and spent 2 years almost over there, just a little short of 2 years, flying for Columbia over there.
Okay, let's back up. Let's talk about what you did in Papua New Guinea. What did you fly? What did you do there? I'm guessing you weren't doing tours of the beach over there.
Yeah. So Papua New Guinea, it is not my favorite place. If I was offered the chance to go back, I would start thinking about flying for the airlines probably. So yeah, Papua New Guinea, I shouldn't say all that. It wasn't a bad job. It was a pretty good gig, but basically we were flying oil rigs. So Papua New Guinea is a very, very rich country in oil and in natural gas and in all kinds of other, minerals and stuff like that. So we were flying as a contractor for another company who basically did oil drilling. And so we were flying their oil rigs, up and down mountainsides basically. So, pretty remote. You're in this camp. They've got these oil camps. And so there's like fences and guards all around. And essentially you just take pieces and parts, fly them up a hill. They build a rig up there and then back down. And it's everything from parts of excavators, pipes, to like, we'd fly fuel up there for them, big blivets of fuel so that they could, run their machinery and all that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, that was what we did. And I was at that time flying the Chinook and the Wright seat. So we have two versions of the Chinook. There's what you guys know of a Chinook is probably the CH-47. That's the military version of a Chinook. We also have a civilian version actually of the Chinook, which was built. These are Boeing aircraft. So they were built by Boeing. And so the 234 is a civilian version of the Chinook, and Columbia Helicopters, to my knowledge, owns all of the 234 airframes that still exist. Some of them aren't airworthy, but we own, I believe, every one of them. And so most of these other companies are flying what's the CH-47, which is a restricted category aircraft. So,
okay. And then for that Chinook, when you're transporting these parts, they're hanging from a cable.
Yeah, I should have clarified that.
What is that? How does that work?
Yeah. Exactly? So we use now I'm going to forget the length. I believe in Papua New Guinea, we used a 250 foot cable, a long line is what we call it. So, I'm going to back up real quick, 'cause there's a super cool history with this. When I see helicopters, I always wanted to go long line. That's something that I just always thought was super cool. It's super fascinating to see these guys flying around with a line underneath the helicopter doing work, whatever that work is. And, when I was learning about it, I was actually reading, and the guy who really developed that is the guy who created Columbia Helicopters, the founder. His name's Wes LaMotta. And he, essentially was out setting power line poles. This is a long time ago. I should know the dates. It's probably in the 50s or 60s. And he was setting power poles out in Eastern Oregon, and he was struggling because he was basically relying on the ground crew to help him set these poles. And so he decided that there was a better way to do it than trying to listen to their directions. And so he landed, they took the door off the helicopter. He actually, I think, switched seats even. It was in a helicopter where you don't sit in the left seat. And he sat in the left seat and went out and started flying, basically looking down. And he calls it direct visual operational control. And it's essentially what we know now as longlining. And so that's a pretty challenging skill for any pilot to learn. So as a helicopter pilot, flying helicopters is a challenging skill in the first place. It's not unlearnable. It's like any other skill. It just takes time and practice. And pretty much anybody can learn it. For the long lining, it is very, very challenging because now you took your, you have 1,000 hours or 2,000 hours or 5,000 hours, how many hours you have. And all of that is based on some visual reference ahead of you. So you're looking at the horizon, the way the airplane, you know, window and cowling sit on that horizon. And that's how you control the aircraft. And you can do a really good job because you have a ton of experience controlling it based on those cues. Now you take and you look straight down and you try to control an aircraft while looking straight down and you lose that whole horizon that you have. And so it's a very challenging skill to learn. I will not claim to be good at it or experienced at it, but I've done it. And at that time when I was in, when I was in Papua New Guinea, Columbia helicopters, I should back up still. Columbia helicopters are famous for it. They're basically the ones that started it. And we pride ourselves in being super good at it, at precision sets, at all kinds of stuff with the long line. There are tons of other companies now who are also really, really good at it and phenomenal pilots out there that are doing this work. And so it's a super cool thing really to do. So yeah, in Papua New Guinea, that's what we were doing. We were flying those things up with a long line and you can set them down. It gives you a chance to set things down in a place where you can't land an aircraft or fly things that are big that you can't fit in an aircraft. And so it's a lot more flexibility on how we can do it. You know, we took, in Papua New Guinea, we flew 40-foot shipping containers that were actually offices. They were doctor offices to a bunch of remote villages so that these people had access to some basic healthcare type things. And there's no way you could fit a 40-foot shipping container into a helicopter and land it anywhere in Papua New Guinea, except for maybe Port Moresby, the capital, because there's just no runways or big enough runways, right? Stuff like that.
Okay. So you're on the ground prior to takeoff. You have this long line attached to you, I imagine. Do you take off, hover, and then they attach the equipment to you, or is the long line already attached? Like, walk us through, and then like the emergency, how you disconnect, and like, can you just go through the process of hooking up and dropping something?
Oh yeah. So it's, I don't even know where to start. So typically it's attached when you take off. That's most common to the belly. And there's all kinds of things you can do depending on what you're trying to carry. And so in Papua New Guinea, we were doing a lot of quick turn loads where they're pretty fast and they were built by our guys. We had guys on the ground that were building the loads and we had, very specific ways to build those loads based on the way we had the aircraft set up. And so in that one, we had they call it a four part. So at the bottom of the hook or bottom of the load, there's essentially four different chains that are coming off with hooks on them. And they can basically put each of those on like the four different corners of a shipping container or the four different corners of a pallet or something like that. And so that's essentially how you pick up the load. And they were just hooks on the end of that. And so we would have our guys hook us up to those loads. And so we would fly it in and they would hook us up to the load. And then we would fly it away. Somebody would disconnect it at the other end. There are different ways for us to disconnect the load if we want to in flight. Obviously in an emergency, you don't want this weight hanging below the helicopter. And so there's ways you can release it from the belly of the helicopter. And there's ways that you can release it from the other end, like at the remote hook. In Papua New Guinea, we actually didn't have the remote hook at the end of the line because we had guys everywhere that we were going to release it. And if there was an emergency, we would have just what we call pickle the load, but we would have gotten rid of the whole thing from the belly of the helicopter.
So I have a question. You're dropping all this stuff on the side of the mountain, but how did you get the people there in the first place?
They actually, so they go up and fly up there. They have, I don't know who makes the first spot, but somebody makes it, you know, hikes up there, I guess. I don't know. The first people who get up there. But they would fly in a 212, actually. It was just another helicopter, right? Bell 212. They would fly in crew back and forth. And so even to my, oil base, I don't know what you call it, oil base, camp. I guess, we flew into it. What camp? Oh, camp. That's a better. Actually, oil camp. That's it. You got it.
Yeah, that's what you said.
So did you ever have to? Yeah. Did you ever have to practice like pickling a load? Because I imagine that's got to aerodynamically. That's got to be challenging or
so
feel weird. I don't know what.
So it is a little weird. I've never. I'm gonna put myself out there, guys. I never pickled a load intentionally. I have pickled a load inadvertently. Luckily, never as a commercial work. This was in my training, but I went up and there's two buttons, one that releases the remote hook at the bottom of the line and one that releases it from the bottom of the helicopter. And you know right away, because as soon as you do it, the helicopter just bounces. I mean, it's like,
yeah,
it's just like kicking out a huge load out of your airplane, right? The performance is insane. And so, yeah, I did, while I was training twice, release the load from the bottom of the helicopter.
And that's kind of like a, there's those who have and those who will kind of a thing, I imagine.
Yeah, to some extent. Not every pilot will agree with me on that. Yeah, you know, it happens, right? We had a guy in Afghanistan who he pickled a car. It was a up armored vehicle, and it got picked over by the locals really fast. In that case, they thought it was a wiring issue, maybe, where we have these pretty intense control heads on the collective, which is one of our flight controls, and he was, we think, playing with a button on it, and it wasn't supposed to release it, but it released it, and so, you know, the car got dropped. And yeah, when you drop water, you're going with, you know, I don't know what 90 gallons of water weighs, right, but a couple hundred pounds, and then you release that, and it's pretty wild. In a Chinook, we fly helicopters. I think the Chinook has 2,900 pounds or 2,900 gallons, something like that. So the amount of weight 2,900 gallons of water is insane. It's a lot. So yeah. Yep, the Chinook will do every bit of water that like one of those seats, the single engine air tankers.
Yeah,
it'll do a similar amount of water as those guys. So they're carrying a lot of water.
So why didn't you like it? Was it just rough living in the oil camp? Is that what the, were you sleeping on a cot and like getting bit by mosquitoes, or what was the?
Luckily, so there were places that were like that where they actually slept in tents and stuff. We had these little shipping containers that were like half of a shipping container. That was my bedroom, which was pretty comfortable. The food wasn't amazing. The flying was the biggest thing. We just didn't fly very much, and we weren't, the weather was really bad. And then at the end, they were basically not building any more oil rigs. There was a change of leadership in Papua New Guinea that caused a lot of the oil companies to get out. And actually, ultimately, we don't have a helicopter there anymore. We did it for like 30 years. And it was food was not very good at all. It was just uncomfortable, wet and rainy all the time. Just not like, not my favorite place in the world. The locals, we worked with some of the locals who were amazing. Some of the guys we worked with were just super positive people, even though, I mean, it's a third world country, right? It's the stuff that we would never have a chance to deal with at all. Like, you know, and one of the guys had lost his son and just to something, I can't remember what illness, it was something silly, like something that you might not even go to the doctor's office for here, but his son died of it. You know, I can't remember, it's like strep throat or something stupid like that. It's, geez. I think it's strep throat, but.
It's funny because, go ahead.
No, please, please.
As I say, it's funny because I'm reading this book right now about a guy that was with the CIA that was in Afghanistan, and they talk about like the smell of Afghanistan because they're like burning their own feces, and it's like, and it's funny because you're like, clearly that wasn't your least favorite place. Papua New Guinea was. Must have been really bad because Afghanistan sounds horrible.
It Afghanistan has a lot of negatives against it, but yeah, it ultimately, I think Papua New Guinea, you know, there's other things too, like the internet really sucked. They had all internet that was satellite based and it didn't hardly work, so talking to the family was really hard, and you know, there's just a lot of little things that kind of added for me on Papua New Guinea. So yeah,
so the boss goes, oh, you don't like the wet and rainy,
we can fix that. How do you like dust?
Yeah. Dust, wind, and huge the spiders. Thing's no joke. They're burning poop there. I know for a fact.
To like stay warm. And the guy's like, you literally are breathing in other people's burned poop and you're like tasting it. And he's like, yeah, you kind of get used to it though.
It's true. Like, right. Yeah. Unfortunately. It's pretty nasty in Afghanistan too. Some times of the year are better than others. That's for sure. So winter time's rough.
Do these jobs pay really well? Like you're gone for 30 days at a time. You're in, you know, you're not in the Hyatt like I'm an overnight right now. You know, it doesn't sound like it's kind of the same deal. So,
yeah. Papua New Guinea, not for me. I was in SIC. I just started with the company, so I was a co-pilot, and ultimately it didn't pay great. I took a huge pay cut from my management role at the school to go to Papua New Guinea. The whole idea was, you know, it's like anything, right? In aviation, if you want to get to that next step, sometimes you got to make some sacrifices, right? You guys showed one of the shows I was just listening to was about pay cuts and how to manage them, and it's some great advice in there.
So let's do a little over under, Dan. Would you say an SIC would make over or under $70,000 a year in Papua New Guinea?
Over.
Oh,
okay. Well, over under 100.
Under.
Okay. Yeah. That's pretty good.
You bracketed that up. Your 70 is a pretty close guess. Yeah, your 70 is a pretty close guess.
But what about the head dude there? So
he's making good money. I don't know what they're making. As you move up into a command pilot role with a company, it's significantly better for sure. They considered Papua New Guinea a low risk area, which in my opinion wasn't very low risk. Like, we flew over a war zone where they were burning houses and at the night we could hear them shooting at each other. And so that's, I think, ultimately why in New Guinea it wasn't my favorite. There's a lot of other things that happen in Afghanistan, the same stuff, like the same kind of things happen in Afghanistan, but we couldn't hear it or see it because we were behind the wall of a base, you know? So it's a lot more comfortable.
And then you get shipped off immediately then to Afghanistan.
Yeah. So essentially the whole goal was to get to Afghanistan, and then talk about pay. It was pretty good in Afghanistan. We got high risk pay. We got bonuses in Afghanistan after you'd been there for a year. And so the money increased pretty rapidly, and the opportunities to move into a command pilot seat also increased rapidly because they're really busy. They're flying a lot. There's a lot of turnover. And in Papua New Guinea, that just wasn't the case. You were stuck there. There's a guy who's there for like 3 years as a SIC and just no chance to move at all. And I don't know how he did it. Honestly, the guy's crazy.
He must be
so an SIC in Afghanistan, like six figure, like over 100K is
pretty much you're
possible.
Starting out right at six figure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then just goes up from there. Yeah. And so I went over to Afghanistan, and it was incredible. Afghanistan was, first of all, I'm a hardworking guy. I like to be kind of hustling and doing things, and I get bored pretty quick. And we were flying literally like maxing out duty days, you know, flying 8 to 10 hours a day as a two-person crew and 14 hours of duty day. Like, at the end of the day, they were trying to get us off the ramp to get us home, you know, saying sometimes our managers would help us finish paperwork and stuff like that to just get us home and get us out of there, which was awesome. I loved it. We would literally start the Chinook in the morning and not shut down for the whole day. We hot fuel. We do the whole thing. You just top out and pee, and that's it.
That's what I was going to say. So I think what a lot of fixed wing pilots don't understand, and I certainly didn't until I was exposed to it, is that 8 hours of flying a helicopter is extraordinarily demanding flying compared to like the 8 hours of flying that I do flying an airliner or something. Like, so my biggest exposure to helicopters was heli skiing, and the guy would do like 100 land. He would do more. I'd talk to him. I was like, I think he does more landings in a day than I do in an entire year, but he's doing it on top of a mountaintop, like in snow that, like, I mean, where we just cut down a couple of trees so he could land, like, crazy, you know, what's crazy to me. And he's just like, oh, it's just like, it's so many reps and you're doing that for that many hours. Like you're actually paying attention like the entire time, where it's like, you know, when you're flying an airliner and autopilot for 5 hours at whatever altitude, like it's not that demanding.
Sudoku champion.
I don't think that there's any secret on that, but so when you say that, like, if you actually stop and think about what the flying is and you're up, down, hand flying the whole time, like that's real deal, actual work. And you're doing it for 8 hours. And I'm tired after flying an airliner for 8 hours, and I'm not even doing half, you know, not even a fraction of that work. So.
Yep. Yeah, it's a pretty high workload gig. Yeah. And you do, you know, like you said, so we would, like in Afghanistan, we had our base. Mainly we were out of Bagram. We also had a base in Jalalabad. But out of Bagram, we would fly. And, you know, for example, in the morning, you would take off. We would be we would pre-flight in the dark. You know, you have lights and all that stuff, obviously, but you pre-flight in the dark, you're off the ground as soon as the sun comes up. And we would fly right off of our ramp, basically over to, we'd like load up cargo or passengers. We'd fly over to get long lines if we had them that day. And you land, you have to get out the long line, and then you pick up and you pick up your long line. And so even before you start, you've got two, maybe three landings. It depends on if we needed fuel. Sometimes we go get fuel over there. So before you even start the day, you might have three or four landings, you know, before you're even on the roll, like getting, that's just getting going. Right. So, and yeah, the autopilots, the 107 that I flew, as a command pilot in does not have an autopilot. It has a SAS system. So a stability augmentation system. Essentially it's designed to stop movement. So if it pitches, yaws or rolls, it will try to stop it. Doesn't return it to original place. It'll just try to, you know, stop the motion. Whereas the Chinook had an autopilot, but we actually don't fly with it on because when we have long lines, we can't fly with it on. They're not that good. Honestly, they don't really work that well. They're just autopilot in a helicopter is a challenging thing. I think these helicopters also were built like in the '60s, right? You know, same technology sent men to the moon. So it's adequate, but it's ancient, you know, so they don't work very good, but yeah, high workload, lots of hot. So Afghanistan has two nice seasons. The spring and the fall are really nice. It's not windy. It's not ridiculously hot. It's not ridiculously cold. And then it has summer, which is insanely windy, like blow you off the top of the helicopter windy some days. And, or the winter, which is inversions and essentially a whole bunch of smoke and nasty, that stuff you were talking about earlier. Really, I believe a lot of times it's actually goat poop that they're burning. That's at least what we joked about. I don't know if that's true, but either way, it's not healthy stuff to be breathing in. And yeah, we just, you know, you just got to go do work, right? You're flying in 3 mile visibility a majority of the time, you know, 4 mile visibility. If we had more than that, it was a treat in the wintertime. And so a lot of times you're flying in kind of crappy weather, super mountainous terrain. You're watching out, you know, for the guys on the ground trying to send you lead presents. You know, you got to kind of manage your altitudes and stuff. It's a lot of work. There's a lot of workload involved with that one. So,
wow. And so you're moving equipment to these different locations, and you're talking about the threats on the ground. Would you have to be like several thousand feet in the air to be clear of that, right?
Yeah. So typically we tried to fly no lower than 1500 feet. That was kind of our minimum. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, 2000 feet to 1500 feet is what we shot for. Some places we can't do that because, I mean, you're in the foothills of the Himalayas, so they're pretty high mountains, you know, around you. And so, yeah. And basically our mission was to fly whatever the DOD wanted. It was everything from toilet paper rolls and cigarettes to ammo and people and dogs. I mean, whatever you can think of that they might need, we probably flew it at some point. So,
and when you had a landing zone, did you have somebody there like securing it, or how would you know it was safe to land?
Yeah, that's a good question. So all of the places that we went to, we're not military, we're a contractor, and we fly. If you look up the pictures of our helicopters, they're giant and they're red and they're white, which doesn't make a ton of sense in a war zone. But we would fly into these FOBs, they're forward operating bases. And so they're manned by somebody, either coalition troops or US troops, you know, some portion of that. And they're guarding it. So we had a few FOBs where we landed outside of the official wire. And for those, they would bring security people out. They would have, you know, guys marked up and posted and off kind of in the shadow of a FOB. So it's pretty safe. Right. But yeah, you go just land and unload whatever you've got. You try to minimize the risk. I never had it happen, but there's a few people that went to FOBs that were under attack while they were there, or, you know, got put under attack right before, right afterwards. Luckily for me, I was there towards the end of the war, so there was a lot less of that. But you hear plenty of stories, you know.
So you land at the FOB, they're under attack. Oh, I got your toilet paper right here, guys. Yeah.
kick it out and get out of there.
See ya.
Yeah. Here you guys go. Have fun.
maybe there's some bullets in here. I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So that's, it was a really crazy fun job, though. I really liked it. The work was amazing. The people that we worked with were amazing. The program that they were doing was amazing. Everybody involved was just super awesome, you know, and it was rewarding. It was a lot of work, super fast pace. And, yeah, you know, there's threats, there's things. I don't know. The scariest things actually happened on base for me, which I would have expected. It was while flying. There's a couple times where like we saw tracer fire at night while we were doing maintenance flights around the base. And that's a spooky thing, but you know, it wasn't super, super bad. And I'll share two stories real quick. So we were sitting there. We have what's called a CRAM. Have you guys familiar with that at all? So a CRAM, it looks like an R2-D2 unit. It's just like the top of an R2-D2. It's usually surrounded by like HESCO, they call it, which is the big like dirt-filled cardboard boxes, basically, and wire mesh boxes, and they build walls out of them. And so the CRAM, the whole goal is that it would shoot rockets down. So when I first got over there, we were getting rocketed a couple times a week. And so these guys like shoot a rocket at the base. It's kind of hopes and dreams if they hit anything. It's usually pretty unlikely that they do any damage. And a CRAM would try to shoot the rocket out of the sky, which it was kind of wild to watch, but it's, you know, I don't know, it's got like a 50 caliber machine gun on it, and it just launches these bullets at this thing as it's flying over. So it's kind of a cool little air show to watch. We had one right outside of our rooms, and I was in the shower, and it was super early. We used to wake up at like 1 a.m. to work out, and then we'd shower and then go in and pre-flight and all that kind of stuff. And so I'm sitting in the shower, just, you know, kind of half asleep still, trying to wake up. And all of a sudden the CRAM goes off, shooting this rocket out of the sky. And I went full fetal in the shower floor. I just was like, it is so loud. And it's right outside. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to die, and hit the floor. I was so glad there was nobody else in the bathroom, because it would have been, yeah, screamed like a little girl, the whole thing. So, so that was one of the scariest ones for me. And then, which it wasn't that bad really. The other one, we had actually a vehicle based IED, which is an improvised explosive device that hit the base while I was there. So in the morning, a lot of times we'd have about 15 to 20 minutes between after eating breakfast and when the sun actually came up and we started the helicopters to call family. And that was kind of the best time zone wise to try and make that phone call. So I just called my wife, and all of a sudden this explosion went off, and it was like knocked everything off the walls and just an insane explosion. We get explosions sometimes when a rocket hits and stuff like that, but this one was clearly different. And so we didn't really know what was going on. And I think I screamed out OF and hung up the phone, which I regretted, because I was really worried that my wife was like, here's this explosion and oh, fuck. And then I go running. Yeah. But yeah, so we have bunkers that we go into, and we didn't know what was happening. But while we're getting into the bunker after the explosion, we start seeing tracer fire going back and forth near the entrance of the base. And essentially there was, these guys hit the outside. There was like a hospital attached to the base. And so they hit that with a V-bid and blew a hole in it. And then they had a suicide bomber who ran in to try and blow a hole into the base, was successful. But of course, you know, I don't know what you have to do to convince somebody to attack a U.S. military base. I mean, it's pretty low chances of success, but those guys basically got turned around pretty quick. But then for the most of the day, we were stuck in a bunker. At first, we didn't know what was going on. It was, you know, I was like, what am I doing here? How am I in this situation where, you know, I'm seeing fire going back and forth between these guys and I'm hearing explosions. We're watching, you know, the Apaches out there and the F-16s dropping. Ultimately, the F-16s dropped a bomb on the building. That was the end result, is they actually just blew them all up and called it. But it was a really scary and crazy day. And for the first 30 minutes, I was pretty sure I was in the wrong line of work. It changed my plan.
Wow. So then, you know, you're just, and then eventually somebody comes and knocks on the bunker door and he's like, all right, that toilet paper ain't going to fly itself, boys.
That was pretty much it. Let's go. We're out loading up toilet paper a few hours later.
Let's go, guys. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So, and maybe you mentioned this, but you're doing that's like a 1 month on, 1 month off rotation.
It is.
Also?
Yep. Yep. So a lot of travel, you know, the rotation life is actually really nice. I liked that because when you're at work, you're working hard. And then when you're home, you're just totally disconnected. You don't have to worry about nothing. Yeah. You just get to relax and enjoy the family time. So.
Cool. So when did that end?
Yeah, I did a rotation in March, I think, was my last one. COVID kind of messed up all of our rotations. We were doing 6 weeks on with 8 weeks on for, I don't remember. It was long. We were doing, you know, almost double the time because of that and because of the challenges traveling. But, we ended in, I think it was in March or April I ended, and then we got notice right after I came home that we were going to be out of there by June. So we were all out by June. We missed all the crazy drama at the end, which I'm very grateful for. And we were, yeah, we were out. So now Columbia is finding other work for the aircraft. We had a couple aircraft in Turkey fighting fires. We had a huge number of aircraft in the United States fighting fires this year with, you know, our fire season, right? And so there's a couple aircraft that are still in Dubai. They're just parked there until we find a better, you know, find work for them or find what the next step is. Let's see, we've got a couple aircraft in Australia to see what fire season does down there. I think there's one aircraft in Chile, something like that. So we're kind of spread all out. And ultimately they end up having me asked if I would like to fly their airplane again, or if I would like to fly airplanes again. So I've been flying a King Air 200, supporting this kind of like aircraft in the United States fighting fires. When an aircraft goes AOG, I go out there and fly a part to it or a specialized mechanic, something like that, to help get the aircraft back up and back ready to fight fires. So, and then I've been doing a little flight training, flight testing. I'm right by the office, so when they need a maintenance flight, they give me a call and, you know, I'll go in and help do a maintenance run or whatever on the ships. So staying current as a command pilot in a 107 and then flying a King Air.
So let's talk a little bit about the Chinook and the 107. And like Max and I were discussing before this call, like the road, we have dumb questions because we don't know anything. So there's obviously two rotors on those helicopters, right? Are they spinning the same direction? Are they opposite direction? We have some guesses, but
I want to hear your
walk
guesses.
Us through kind of the mechanics of how all this works.
I'm looking at the thing. He goes, I go, I think they're spinning opposite direction because they have to counteract the torque of one another. He goes, right. Yeah, but they overlap, so wouldn't they hit each other? And I'm like, I don't think so.
I'm looking at these pictures. It looks like they're between each other. I don't know.
Yep.
Right.
You guys are right on all accounts. So they do spin opposite directions because they have to counteract torque. That's why traditional helicopters have a tail rotor, right, to counteract torque. And the tail rotor is taking energy away from the power plant. It has to use some energy. And so the idea with a tandem rotor on top is that you eliminate that wasted energy. And so it becomes a much more efficient aircraft. And that's they can lift an insane amount. So, you know, the 107, it can carry 21,000 pounds is our max gross with an external load. The Chinook, it's like 56,000. I should know that off the top of my head. I'm still rated as an SIC in it, but, it can carry an insane amount, you know, almost the same weight the aircraft is. It can carry. It's really impressive. And so, yeah, they do mesh together, the blades. So when they're rotating, they're in, you know, basically one goes across and the next one, and they just mesh together. They do not touch. There's actually an aircraft, if you get real froggy and want to look it up, it's called a K-Max. And the K-Max is sort of similar, but its rotors are together in the middle and they mesh together going up.
I've seen that.
And they actually have a tolerance for how much those can rub together. And so that's super spooky to me. If you watch a video of them starting, it looks like two idiots slapping each other. They're like coming around and smacking each other.
Yeah, I've seen that. So, yeah. That's a wild looking helicopter.
Yeah, but it can do a ton. It's the same. It can lift an insane amount of weight for how heavy it is. And so, yeah, they're super fascinating. So there's a few aerodynamic differences that happen because of the tandem rotor and a few things that as a pilot, you don't have to worry about, and a few new ones that you do have to worry about, but they're essentially super efficient. And that's why they created it. I'd love to see, you know, Boeing or one of these companies come back out with a newer version of it and redesign it. Cause I think that there's a ton of potential with, you know, better, newer designs that they could do even more. And, yeah, they're fascinating. They're super fun to fly too.
Yeah. And there's super like, fun. There's a whole transmission and drive shaft. And so if you lose an engine, obviously it continues to drive both rotors and that seems like a lot of complexity.
Yeah. So the complexity, like the transmission and rotors, is actually the easier part. Some of the control systems and the way they mix the controls, they end up having each rotor head has two inputs to it. And so one to tip the rotor head sideways and one to tip it or to increase the pitch as a whole. And there's that comes from you having, you know, all these other inputs as a pilot, essentially 1, 2, 3, you know, 4 directions that you can move. And so somebody engineered those 4 pieces to come together to be 2 outputs. And I'm always curious if the guy or gal who designed it knew that it was going to do that, or they're like, well, let's just try this one. That's not it. Let's try this, you know?
It's a mechanical mixer. Like, it's not like, you know, fly by wire where you just write software, you know, now it's like a mechanical, that's amazing. that they figured
exactly,
that out.
Exactly. Yeah. Super fascinating. So, yeah.
Okay. So, these helicopters you're talking about, Commander and an SIC, when you're flying the 107, you've got obviously one pilot that's, you know, the pilot flying, right? What would the non-flying or the pilot monitoring do? Is it pretty similar to a fixed wing where it's just, I'm kind of working the radios and doing that kind of stuff? Or are there other things that you have to do that we don't know
about? So for the most part, similar as an airplane where they're monitoring radios and running checklists for you and just kind of backing you up. They might be checking on engine instruments and things like that, which I assume an airplane SIC is doing as well, you know, just kind of monitoring things. In the 107, that's really true because the 107 is a relatively pilot-friendly aircraft. It flies pretty nicely and it doesn't require a lot of work. The Chinook also is that way. The military version, it has a FADEC and things like that. So it monitors its engines really well. The 234 is pretty different in that regards, where the 234 is older technology, doesn't have a FADEC. And so when you do, for example, a high power pull and you're trying to lift something heavy or something like that, the rotors will start to droop on it. And it has some droop built into it, but then you're pulling a lot, like, you know, you're talking about dragging out something like 20,000 feet, 20,000 pounds out of a, you know, out of the forest at the top of a mountain. And so they're using a ton of power. And so actually the co-pilot will beep the engines using an electronic beep switch that's on the collective head and adjust that to make sure that they go up to the max power, but not over, right? So they're basically trying to keep it on the edge of its limits all the time. And the pilot flying can't do that because their head's out the window. They're looking down, making sure, you know, this 20,000 pound weight isn't going to smash into something and break something. And so there's kind of a nice dance between the two where the SIC is managing that power. And it actually even goes the opposite way. When they get up and they finally get out of there, they have to beep the power back before they lower the power out of it, because otherwise the engines will overspeed. It gets really expensive. And not the engines, actually, the rotors will overspeed in that case, the rotor RPM. But so it's a kind of a cool thing. And a lot of times at that case, the non-flying pilot is actually controlling the power and raising in what we would call the power, which is ultimately going to cause the lift. It also increases the pitch in the collective blades, which would pull the load out. So there's communication between the two. So for that one, there's a lot of work. And that's probably the most fun crew resource job I've ever done. I'm not real experienced in airplane crew resource management. I haven't flown big jets or, you know, airlines or anything like that, but it's pretty neat.
And is that like, do you guys set a torque or what's your primary power?
Yeah.
Gauge?
So it depends on the aircraft. It changes depending on what helicopter you're flying, and it depends on the altitude. And so for us in the Chinook, oftentimes it was torque, but it also can be the PTIT or the exhaust temperature, right? And so it depends on where you're at. Same thing goes in the 107. I think if between the 107, it would go between NG and your torque, depending on altitude. Most of the time it's NG limited, but it just depends on the situation, honestly. So, and that makes it a little more fun too for the SIC, because they've got to be scanning those instruments and seeing which one's going to come up first. And then there's even balancing between the two engines. You know, you're maybe you have a stronger motor in one side, so you're trying to adjust to maximize it. What we do at Columbia is take out heavy loads a lot of times, and it's max performance. It is right on the edge. And so you're just working the machine as hard as it can work. So
is kind of like one of the dream airplane or helicopters to fly the Sky Crane?
Ooh, that almost thing just like looks the Embry, that's almost like the Embry-Riddle North Dakota debate.
Because that's Ericsson, right? That's like a competitor.
It is,
isn't
yeah.
It?
So Ericsson, HTS. There's a couple other operators that fly them as well. Ericsson's a big one, and ultimately, I believe that the Sky Crane is the ugliest helicopter I've ever seen. so I'm going to stick with the Chinook, but yeah, I think. It depends on the pilot, as if the heavy stuff's a dream job. You know, it's just like an airplane. Some guys dream to fly a 747 or a, you know, what, a 380, whatever it is, the big, you know, the biggest of the big stuff. And some guys don't want to do that. They want to do, you know, they want to fly a single pilot Citation that they can take, you know, and just bounce around in or whatever, want the variety or something like that. And so I think that's kind of what it comes down to in a career wise. Again, similar to airplanes, the more you can carry, the more you get paid oftentimes. And so there's, you know, there's a balance there as well, where some people are chasing the money and that's maybe what they do. But a lot of people like EMS as a career goal because it's pretty easy schedule. You're home a lot, you know, stuff like that. It's a good family job. Some guys want to be out in the field in the Alaskan bush, like, you know, living in tents and building, you know, or taking like supplies to lodges or building towers or whatever it is that they're doing. So.
Yeah. Did you ever have any experience when you were over in Afghanistan with Russian helicopters, like Mi-8s and stuff? Because I know those were in the mix because of their ruggedness and reliability. Did you see them?
Yep, we definitely saw them. They were out there. We flew to bases with them. The Afghan army had a few. Some of our coalition friends had them and would be flying them around. I'm not very good with my MIs. I should know what model they were. We actually literally picked one up. They had an old damaged one. And so one day we got a call. I was a co-pilot for this. Unfortunately, I would have really liked to have been the pilot. I was still getting my feet underneath me. And we took the Chinook out there and we actually picked this thing up and flew it to another base where they used it as training for exit, like infill and exfil in a helicopter. And so we flew this, you know, I've got a great picture of a Chinook carrying this giant MI. I want to say it was MI-16, but I don't know if that's right. I might be wrong about that. And so, yeah, it's a great picture though. We flew this thing and added that's long cool. line down there. So yeah, it was neat.
Huh. That's like when a Chevy tows a broken down.
That's exactly what it's like. Yeah. I even like which one you put first there. That was good. Yeah. Well played.
If I'm a listener and I've heard what you're talking about, it sounds exciting. And you're like, man, this sounds like something that I want to do. Is the marketplace good? Is this a good time to be a helicopter pilot, to do the training? You know, it's a significant investment, just like in fixed wing. Are there a lot of opportunities out there? What do you think about the marketplace and people that want to join this industry?
Yeah, the easiest way to answer that is if they're already an airplane pilot, it's very similar. If you don't like the opportunities right now, wait a couple of weeks and there'll probably be a whole set of new ones. And similar to the airplane industry, it's cyclical. And I always say that the airplane industry or pilot industry as a whole, aviation maybe as a whole, is cyclical and matches the economy just to greater extremes, it seems like. And so oftentimes when the economy is sort of depressed, the pilot and aviation community is even more depressed. And then when the economic environment's good, then aviation's even better. And helicopter pilots are similar. There's a big shortage of helicopter pilots, just like in the airlines and airplane world. University of North Dakota actually has a helicopter program, but they put together a study here maybe 3 or 4 years ago now, but it was very similar, where it was projecting big pilot shortages, and just like everybody else is. And we see it right now. There's a lot of shortage, especially for skilled pilots, which is always the hard part, right? You know, how do you get that skill and how do you build it? But there's a lot of companies right now that are being pretty creative and finding ways to train pilots and get them to that skill level. So anybody that's thinking about it, if you're curious about it, I would go do it. Find out more information at least and see what you can do. But there's a lot of potential for pilot jobs. And the EMS world right now, there's literally hundreds of postings. And I get emails and stuff like that on a pretty regular basis from both, like you guys get the regional ones, maybe the, you know, here you can have 60 grand if you start tomorrow. The same thing, maybe not the 60 grand, but similar things, similar emails come across for helicopter pilots. And so there's a lot of opportunity right now. It's a pretty good time to get in the industry for sure.
So what are kind of like the cush helicopter jobs? Like, is it flying like VIPs and or heli skiers, or what's like the kind of the cush top tier?
So I think the biggest thing depends on how you define cush. So heli skiing would be super cool, and it's a really, really intense job. It's hard and it's got a lot of respect, and you know, there's cool videos out there about them doing it. And but I think a lot of times those guys aren't really living in cushy environments. They're usually kind of out there in the field and working tough schedules, and it's a hard field to break into. You really got to find someone to help give you that, because almost every job like that wants experience. So probably the two main cush ones would be the EMS is probably the biggest. It's a good job. You get paid well. You get a lot of time at home, like I said, in a pretty predictable schedule. Offshore oil is a big one. You fly big aircraft for that and you get paid well, and it's a pretty predictable schedule. And so that's a pretty big one. The VIP stuff is there. I don't know a lot about it. It's a really small market. It's not, you imagine a number of people that can afford to buy a business jet, then imagine the number of people that can afford to buy and operate a helicopter is even smaller than that group. And so it's a pretty small niche and I'm just not familiar. Okay. Yeah. And then otherwise, a lot of people just love utility work, which is kind of what we do. And so, but there's just many different variations on that. Fires, building helicopter, building power lines with helicopters and stuff like that. A lot of those jobs are really good. A lot of the pilots who really like the finesse and the hand flying portion go there, which is partly why I'm there. It's what I like. And it's challenging to find enough people with those skills, but the lifestyle is challenging. You know, a lot of time away from home and a lot of rugged places you're living, stuff like that. So,
but like Columbia, Ericsson, those are the companies you would go to, and that's kind of your final job, right? I mean, that's a career. You could make your entire career at a place.
Absolutely.
Like that, right?
Yep. And a lot of people do. Yep. So there's a lot more of them that are smaller ones. You know, those are a couple of the big ones for sure. So.
All right. Well, Dan, one final question here, you know, as we're talking about the marketplace and the jobs, and I start to think about the future. We see drones are popping up and doing a lot of aerial jobs that maybe helicopter pilots used to do. Max and I were at NBAA, or I was at NBAA this year. They've got the electric air taxis they're trying to pioneer, and it just seems like there's a lot of change kind of in the rotor space in the future. Have you seen any of that? Do you have any thoughts on what's next?
So I don't know a whole lot about it. I'll just start with that. And ultimately, though, it is making a big change. A lot of the helicopter operators that I know have incorporated some sort of a drone program into their operation. And so they're doing, instead of, in my opinion, what would be, you know, what would be my initial reaction to it, which is get out of here, drones. I want to do the jobs. They're kind of embracing them and figuring out a way to put them to work and to make money with drones as well, and a way to supplement their helicopter operation, which I think is pretty smart. The Helicopter Association International is the big helicopter association, at least in the United States and multiple other countries. They've adopted drones and this eVTOL stuff into sort of their realm as caretakers for it and stuff like that, which is, I think, really smart and a way to try and incorporate that into the future. There's no doubt that they'll change the way helicopters are used. I think that there's a good chance that a lot of the missions helicopters do will one day be replaced by drones and at least be partly replaced by drones. I think there's always going to be some amount also, though, of flying that's done by humans, just like similar to airplanes, right? I don't see a future, at least in the near future, where we all strap into a drone and fly across the country. You know, I still get a blue screen of death sometimes from my computer and, you know, stuff like that. So I'm still pretty hesitant on that. But I think there's a future where maybe some cargo's moved that way, or, you know, maybe right now a lot of film stuff that would be shot with a helicopter can be shot with a drone. And so, you know, there's still guys out there that are doing the really cool helicopter footage and probably will be for a little while. But at some point it makes a lot more sense to fly a drone underneath a bridge than it does a helicopter, you know? So, that's probably all I have to say on it, really. That's all I can contribute with that one. But I think that they will impact it. And I think that the smart operators are incorporating them already into their fleet. So
that's why you just fly the big, heavy helicopters that have to lift stuff. And I don't think drones are going to be doing that.
That's what I'm hoping. Yeah, that's what I'm hoping. You know, it's funny, though. K-Max is actually one of the pioneers. They're putting drones in K-Maxes and they're flying them with a drone. And I think the military, the Marines or the Navy have been heavily involved with that one. So I could be wrong about that, but there's a lot of even heavier lift helicopter stuff that they're starting to try to figure out, you know, can we do it with drones and is there a way? So yeah, it'd be interesting to see. There's a safety point.
I guess I've got to separate like drone and electric.
Yeah.
Like, you mean remotely piloted is what you should be like on the K-50 and stuff.
Yeah. Really.
Yep,
yeah.
That's true. Yep. Some separate things there for sure. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we want to get some stories from you, but first I want you to tell us a little bit about your show, the Aloft with Dan podcast that you launched, and What are you up to?
Yeah. So I created a podcast mostly because I was pretty darn bored after Afghanistan. I was waiting to see what we were going to be doing and trying to figure out what my life was going to be like. So since I'm flying this King Air now and kind of on call for the company, I don't really have a set schedule at the moment. And so I had a lot of free time and I have a ton of friends and I just enjoy just like this. I just love talking about aviation and about kind of cool things. And I find that a majority of the people are super passionate about aviation. So I just tried to find really cool people. I call it rad people doing rad things in aviation. And we go out and we just chat about what they're doing. And my goal is to kind of highlight the non-traditional career paths. So things that are other than airline pilots, other than corporate pilots, other than sort of the standard helicopter, like EMS jobs. We'll have some of all of them on, but I'm trying to find other people. So like we had a marketer on just the other day. We're gonna have an airport manager on here in a couple of weeks. You know, helicopter pilots doing unique things, airplane, seaplane pilots. I got a guy, next week's episode actually is going to be a seaplane pilot who flies beavers for the Forest Service, which is fascinating. He has a really cool history. So that's the point of the show. And yeah, I'm just having fun with it right now. It's just been a blast. That's kind of what it's all about.
Awesome. Well, we will have a link in the show notes to your show, and I encourage folks to check it out. I've really enjoyed kind of learning the edges of the envelope with some of the folks you're talking to.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
It's a great idea. All right. We're ready.
All right.
Give us your best stuff.
I'm going to hit you with a story here. This story was when I was young. I actually, it's an airplane story, so you're going to have to bear with me on the airplane story. But okay. When I first got my airplane, I was flying, and like I said, around this place where they flew 206s in the backcountry, I really wanted to be a bush pilot. I was thinking Alaska, you know, like flying, landing anywhere that's not paved. And so these guys all were talking about landing on this lake called Flathead Lake, which is right by where I grew up. And in this wintertime, there's a big, maybe a 2 mile wide beach, about 10 miles long. And these guys were taking their airplanes out there and landing them on the beach. And I thought, I mean, holy smokes, I'm 17 years old. Actually, by then I was 18, but I thought this is going to be super cool. And I asked them if they thought the 150 could do it. And being great bush pilot instructors, they all said, oh yeah, for sure. No problem. And so I went out, I picked an area of the beach that I thought would be fantastic place to land. And I marked it out with sticks and, you know, big, there's a lot of driftwood out there. So I kind of moved some driftwood around to make a runway-esque picture and, loaded up my dog and went out flying, you know, not low fuel, but relatively low fuel, light on fuel, just me and the dog in a Cessna 150 and decided I was going to play bush pilot that day. And so my goal or my plan was I was going to come down, shoot an approach, go around. I was going to come down, touch the wheels, go around. And then if all that went well, I was going to come around and I was going to land it on the beach. And,
wait, so
and
is the snow packed down or what?
So this is springtime. So it was actually spring break. I was off from school. And so it was, I was in high school. This is, you know, maybe part of the story. Why am I such a bad choice? But yeah, it was all melted. So it was like kind of wet. It was just wet sand. So the snow had mostly melted. Right. Yeah. Good question. I should have drove that in there. But, so I went out and I set up for this approach and I did this long final. I had 70 hours, maybe 60 hours. I did, man, it must have been about 70 hours. Very, very low time pilot.
One more question, Dan, before you keep going. Does anyone know you're doing this?
Nobody knows. I was, okay. I should have told somebody, but in my dark, deep down, I knew it was wrong. It was a terrible plan. So nobody knows. And so I'm shooting this approach and I come in and it was a beautiful approach, a huge long final. I'd never really shot like this really long final. We were always in a pattern and stuff. I was pretty new to aviation, right? So I shoot this huge long final. I'm like, man, this is so stable. This is so beautiful, so easy. And I thought to myself, why not? Why not touch the ground? What's the worst that could happen, right? So I convinced myself to touch the ground and it was beautiful. Best soft field landing I had made in all 70 hours I had at that point. And so I set the mains down. I'm feeling really good. I got the power in there. I'm carrying the power, doing the whole wheelie thing down, feeling amazing. And, And I sat there and I spent way too long trying to decide if it was worth committing to this landing or if I should go around and come back and set it up again. And so I was sitting here the whole time thinking, it's pretty good. But I said I was going to go around, but it's pretty good. So I end up finally pulling the power back and I start to slow down. The nose wheel touches down. And then all of a sudden, the plane just abruptly stops, like just right now comes to a stop. I was maybe going 15 knots, 20 knots, like not even registering on the airspeed indicator, but it just lurched to a stop. And I got that real cold, clammy, I actually get it right now, real cold, clammy feeling all over, and pulled the mixture and shut everything off. The dog got out and run around on the beach, happy as could be. And I got, I'll send you guys some pictures that way, at least you guys can see. But I got the wheels basically are the 150, which it's not, you know, I don't know what a diameter of a 150 tire is. It's nothing, right? But they're halfway into the sand. And essentially, I had spent so long trying to decide whether I would land or take off that I just rolled way past where I thought was a good spot to land and just rolled into some soft sand. And so I probably shouldn't even admit this on a podcast, but I'm okay with it. I got out and I walked around. I looked at everything. No damage. The prop looked good. The firewall looked good. You know, I'm not a mechanic. I'm 18 years old. I have no business deciding if this thing's actually safe to fly.
Let me lean on my 70 hours of experience. Exactly. Here, yeah.
All my bush flying that I've done. You know, I landed in the grass field a couple of times.
Drawing on all of the education from John and Martha King at this point.
That's right.
I assess
that's right.
The actually, situation.
That's who I did my training with, too. That's my ground school. Yeah. So good.
Yeah. John and Martha, I pray to you right now.
Please come to me in my time of need. So, it was stuck. It was really stuck. Khakis. I tried to climb in and see if I could start it up. I couldn't. I tried to push it. I couldn't. And so I ended up... I had the dog with me. I'm a runner, so I run pretty regularly. And I ran 5 miles to the end of the beach. And there's basically a city on each end or a town. And so I get to the end of the beach and I called my dad from a bar. There's a bar there. And my dad told him I was at Dell's Bar and I needed him to come pick me up. And he thought I was out doing something I really shouldn't be doing. So he was like, oh, what are you doing there? Why do you have the dog with you? You know, it was a whole thing. And so he came and picked me up. The next morning, we end up going back there and we brought just some strips of plywood that we basically took a sheet of plywood, ripped it down into thirds. And, between him and I, we were able to push it back to the hard sand. And I was able to take off from the hard sand. I'm literally getting that adrenaline, emotional, shaky feeling as I talk about it. But, the airplane, when it took off, it did not want to go off. I actually ended up, inadvertently, I found out from a seaplane pilot later that sometimes on a glassy water takeoff, they'll use ailerons to help brake onto the step. Yeah. And essentially I was like basically shaking the airplane. I was trying to get it to go faster and we're like doing the old hop and hits and all that stuff. And I shook the controls, I think enough that actually one wing popped up and that wheel got on top of the sand and that wing kind of supported the lift at that point, I think. And all of a sudden it accelerated like normal and I was off and was able to take off. But yeah, it was really dumb. I had every bit of invulnerability that you could have on that day and probably all the other hazardous attitudes also. So a really good lesson though. I never did anything like that again. I learned a lot. So,
so you never took the 150 sheet from Meadows?
I didn't. So I flew for that same company flying the 206 into Schaefer Meadows a whole bunch. And Schaefer Meadows is my favorite airstrip of all time. It is the best. It's amazing. So when you get the moose done, Schaefer Meadows has to be on your list.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. It looks awesome.
Oh, it's amazing. So we did take the 150 into Spotted Bear a lot. And actually in my last episode, I talked about landing it in Meadow Creek. So Spotted Bear is just west of Schaefer and Meadow Creek is just west of Schaefer. And Meadow Creek, when I landed there, they actually had seeded half the strip and I landed the 150 there. And it said, in case of emergency, don't use the full strip because they just reseeded a bunch of it. And I'd landed there with my dad. I don't know what it is elevation wise, 4,000 feet roughly. Something like that. And, so I ended up taking off and we wouldn't have cleared you standing at the end of the runway. We ended up kind of following the river out, which you can follow down there. But, I really thought I was a big bad bush pilot flying my 150 in Montana when I was 18 years old. And so
And your dad got in the airplane with you after
he
that,
did,
though, right?
Yes. And that's a okay. testament to him, actually. He knows how dumb I am. So, yeah. Yeah. He didn't fly out with me. I felt pretty bad, actually. I flew over. And when I looked down, when I flew over, he had these three sheets of plywood. I took a survival bag. I had like a 40-pound survival bag I gave him and a whole bunch of crap. Like anything that could come out of the airplane came out. And he packed it all back 5 miles to where the truck was parked.
Oh, jeez. Yeah.
Very jeez. Supportive dad.
Oh, you're kidding yeah. me. He had to pack all
he
that
did.
Out.
Yeah. 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 He's pretty good. So now he owns a 182 with big tires, a big nose fork, and he's letting me borrow that. And you talked about Copalis earlier, the runway that's on the yeah. beach, and I really need to go redeem myself, but I'm still very scared to go do it. I don't know why I have this insane fear of going and landing on this beach. And I got the right aircraft. I got the right situation. It's perfect. And I haven't done it yet. It's been a year now. So,
Okay. What about, have you been into Pacific City yet?
Yes, I've been into Pacific City. Yep. That's a pretty small little runway. It's pretty tricky. It's windy too sometimes.
It's super windy. So Max, Pacific City runway is like right in this little tiny coastal town near where I grew up. And there's this really good Mexican restaurant that was like right at the end of the runway that was really good. So everyone would love to fly in there, but it might be like 1900 feet or like 2200 feet long. It's not very long, but like the Mexican restaurant would get hit by an airplane like every year. Somebody would hit it or crash into it. And I figured out like they would just either close the restaurant or the airport or whatever, but everyone loved to go do it.
1860 feet long.
The 182. Yeah, it's pretty
get
tight.
Get in there.
Anyway, yeah, exactly. Well, Dan, it sounds like you've got a lot more stories to share. You're doing that on your show. So encourage all of our listeners to go check that out. We'll have links in the show notes for that. We really appreciate your time. A little story time with Dan.
Dan the Rotorhead. I love it.
We are looking forward to seeing all of the exciting content you are producing. Thanks for taking the
time.
Yeah,
thank you guys and loving your guys' show. It's been amazing. So keep up the great work. And I just really appreciate you guys having me on. So
awesome, man. Thanks, Dan.
Well, that is going to do it for episode number 68, our 20th and final episode of 2021. I saw something, Max, that they said 2022, you could write it as 2020, TOO or TWO, as in it's version 2
God,
of 2020.
It seems super rosy on paper, and that's what has me mm-hmm. worried.
Yeah, exactly. So, there's a lot to be uncertain about 2022, but here's one thing you don't have to be uncertain about. We will be back with more episodes. Thanks to our partners, Advanced Aircrew Academy, Harvey Watt Insurance, Tim Pope at Cetera Investors. We're going to be around. We got a lot more content planned, and we have a little special reveal for 2022. I'm excited to share with folks in the
community. Sure, people are on the edge of their seats.
Cheers to all of the pilots that are out working over the holidays, moving folks where they need to be, including you, Max. Thank you for making the sacrifices for the folks.
It's funny you talk about working as an airline pilot on the holidays, and my wife and I were driving the other day. She goes, "Why can't airlines just like shut down for Christmas Day or Christmas Eve or whatever?" Like a lot of other businesses, because people really need to travel that bad on Christmas. And I kind of laughed, and she's like, "What?" And I'm like, "This huge, massive moving machine, you can't just stop it and then start it again." I'm like, you think about it. It's so important that airplanes are in the certain cities and crew members and all this. Like, how would you get? I'm like, there's just absolutely no way that is even within the realm of possibility, because it's just, yeah, I said, look at what happened with Southwest when we had all those flight cancellations. It took days to get the operation normalized because everything's out of place. And she's like, "Oh, okay. Never thought about it like that."
Well, at least could just you not work over the holidays, honey?
Yeah.
How about that?
One day.
You know what would be an awesome podcast, Max? That maybe one of our listeners could help put together. You say, you can't grind the wheels to a stop and do all that, but it did happen one time. Do you remember when that was?
9/11.
And I would love to talk to somebody who was in the logistics of once everything restarted, what they did. Have you ever read anything about it?
No, that's interesting.
Like heard
how that worked.
That's, I want to, do you know what else we need to, I want to talk about somebody that was flying then and people like that was flying and also on the operational side of like how they did that and restarted everything. That would be super interesting. And the other thing person I really want to talk to was a pilot in like the 70s, like a captain of a wide body airplane at like Pan Am or something, like in 1975.
I want to talk to a TWA L-1011 pilot.
I know one.
In like 1982.
We know one, actually. That's funny. We actually, you know, that's funny. We'll have to ask our friend John. He flew TWA on the L-1011.
I want to know what was up there. I don't know how much it can be shared on a family podcast.
I think there was a thing with the L-1011 where it flew sort of in level flight, pitched up a little bit, and it was really hard for like the cabin attendants because the carts would like want to roll away a lot and stuff. And I guess that was a big problem.
Oh, really? I think didn't the L-1011 have a little elevator on it?
I don't know. I think a lot of those old ones, little elevators that, people would ride, and then they like put like, there's all kinds of shenanigans back in the day.
Okay. All right. Enough shenanigans. Thanks to all of our partners, Advanced Air Crew Academy, Harvey Watt, Tim Pope. 2022 is going to be awesome. We're looking forward to it. 215podcast.com is the website if you want to reach out or send a donation to us. And just remember, as you start 2022, keep in mind,
flexibility. It's the key to what?
Air power. See you guys in 2022.
Black God.
The statements made in this show are our own opinions and do not reflect, nor were they under any direction from any of our employers.